Good afternoon. This is a hearing in In Re Archibald Cunningham, 9th Circuit Docket Number 18-80158. This is a hearing requested by Mr. Cunningham to address whether the 9th Circuit should impose discipline reciprocal to the disbarment order disbarring him from practice in the state of California. And so I just wanted Mr. Cunningham to give you a few of the ground rules. First of all, we're conducting this hearing by video conference from the 9th Circuit in San Francisco, and you are appearing by video conference, and I can see you. Are you able to see me and to hear me? All right. I would like to begin, because this is an evidentiary hearing and you're going to be presenting testimony, I'd like to ask the courtroom deputy here to administer the oath to you.
Hi, Mr. Cunningham. Could you please raise your right hand? Do you solemnly affirm that the statements you're about to make in the case now before this court will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and that you do so under the pains and penalties of perjury?
I do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. All right, so the scope of this hearing is limited to the question whether the respondent, Mr. Cunningham, will continue to be able to practice in the Ninth Circuit. Nothing in this order would affect your ability to practice in any other court or the would call into question the validity of the state court order. And you do have this right to a hearing that you've exercised. And under the governing law, the state court determinations, the findings in state court are accorded a presumption of correctness. You, in this hearing, have the burden of showing that the state bar proceeding did not afford you adequate notice and opportunity to be heard, or that the evidence that was presented was not sufficient to support the disbarment order, or that some other grave reason exists that would prevent the Ninth Circuit from recognizing the state court determination. You have submitted a number of filings in response to this court's order to show cause concerning reciprocal discipline. I've read those. I understand your arguments. I want to assure you that you don't need to spend this time repeating any arguments that you've already made, but this is your opportunity to make a showing under the criteria that I've set out. So what do you anticipate your presentation will cover today?
What? Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
What do you propose to present today in this hearing?
Other than testimony and a few documentations, other than that, probably just what's on the record.
All right. So I don't have any initial questions of you. I'm generally familiar with the basis for the discipline and the state bar court determinations. So this is your opportunity, and I'm going to allow you to present your testimony now.
All right. Again, I'm assuming you're Commissioner Shaw, right?
That's correct. I'm sorry I did not introduce myself. Yes, I'm Appellate Commissioner Peter Shaw.
Okay. Just to clarify that. So a Again, thank you for accommodating me. I recently had a malignant brain tumor removed, and I may not be as sharp as I should be. In fact, this week I started chemotherapy, or resumed chemotherapy, 5 days, Monday through Friday on, and then 3 weeks off. So unfortunately, the way it was staggered, my chemotherapy began on Monday, and so I'm suffering a kind of chemo brain, as they say. So bear with me if I'm maybe not as articulate as I'd like to be or as coherent as I should be. But in any event, I think maybe what I should start with is my petition for review and kind of go over some of the high points of that, because as you notice, and probably in one of my pleadings or attachments sent this week, I noticed that the issues that I raised were really never addressed in my petition for review. It was summarily denied, and the presumption is that's fine and dandy. The first thing I would say is that that presumption's all good, but on the other hand, to presume that the state bar's opinion is presumptively valid is also implicitly suggesting that there were no errors in that. And this is particularly difficult because the opinion by the state bar, the summary denial, presumes to be correct. I think In re Hirsch, the Ninth Circuit case, said that a party had the right, presumably, to raise constitutional issues in their petition for review, and that the state bar would address those. In this case, the state bar didn't address any of my constitutional questions. It just apparently summarily denied it without explanation, and apparently rests on the presumption that anything the state bar issues is fine. The thing I find problematic about this is that I presented, and I think in the state bar, rules of procedure, I think 9.16 through A through B lists, grounds for judicial review, provided oral argument and a hearing. In this case, there's been absolutely nothing but the presumption that the state bar was correct. First of all, in my petition for review, I make the point that the state bar doesn't have jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, because I'm being disciplined not for any action under the state bar. The state bar disciplines people for, failing to adhere to the state bar, and all the cases cited in the notice of disciplinary proceedings are cases that were filed not by me, but by the other parties. So we have two sets of cases under the notice of disciplinary proceedings. One segment is my custody dispute. I was sued in a marriage dissolution and have for 10 years been in a custody dispute. You know, my parental rights were summarily terminated by Ms. Schaap, opposing counsel. She asked for that on the day of the hearing from the judge, and he summarily terminated all my parental rights, and then I was denied permission to appeal under the vexatious litigant statute. I haven't seen my daughter, spoken with her, heard her in over 10 years. When she was 9 years old, I lost custody like this.
Can I ask you, excuse me for interrupting, but I have a question about that.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure I have the chronology right. So proposed order terminating custody was summarily approved at the hearing. Was there then...
No. Let me just... I don't mean to be interrupt you, but I just...
No, I want to understand. That's fine.
Really
go
clear
ahead.
About this. It wasn't summarily accepted at the hearing. It was submitted without my knowledge, without any indication. I'd filed an order to show cause to reinstate my 50-50 shared custody. At that hearing on February 26, I said the order was void on its face because it involved a trial by declaration, and as such, it was void. Then opposing counsel, Maria Schaap, submitted after the hearing, without my knowledge, without it ever being raised in the hearing, she submitted an order terminating all my visitation rights based on her view that I said that I wasn't going to obey that order. That order to show cause, I'd filed almost 2 years before to restore 50-50 shared custody. At the February 26, 2010 hearing, I said that order was void on its face because it involved a trial by declaration, which Chief Justice George, State Supreme Court, had said violated the hearsay law without reaching the issue of whether there was a due process violation. So that was my point. When I filed my order to show cause to restore my 50-50 shared custody, that the order was void on its face for violating the hearsay rule and possibly due process, an issue Justice George didn't reach. So at the February 26 hearing, after the hearing, without my knowledge, without my consent, without my ever agreeing, Ms. Schaap said, Mr. Cunningham she submitted an order in which she indicated that I had agreed to the termination of all my parental rights. She forged my name on the signature line by typing it. Judge Mahoney then came and signed it himself. So the order was effective immediately. I didn't hear about or know about this order until I got something in the mail 3 days later. It wasn't an issue presented during the hearing. It wasn't an issue raised. My order to show cause was to restore, not to terminate my parental rights. And the judge went along with that, a facially void order. So I immediately, within a week, filed a motion for reconsideration. It was summarily denied. So for the next 10 years, in that same hearing, Judge Mahoney, the family law judge, declared me vexatious. He would go on to declare me vexatious three times, for being a defendant and trying to regain my custody rights. So he declared me vexatious on that day, declared me vexatious the second time. First time he sanctioned me $22,000. The second time, same facts, same people, sanctioned me $3,000. He would go on to sanction me a fourth time. You know, so the slew of constitutional and procedural due process violations is just stacked one upon the other. First of all, you know, I was given no due process at this hearing. Then the vexatious litigant statute was used to deny me any court access to challenge that order. And the state Supreme Court itself said that the vexatious litigant statute should be interpreted according to its plain language. And the plain language is that, you know, and this was in Chillon versus Girardi, the plain language of the vexatious litigant statute says there's two remedies. First, to declare somebody vexatious, then to get a pre-filing order on them. But Judge Mahoney, in his wisdom, saw fit to have me declared vexatious, not once, but twice. You know, sanctioned me multiple times, $22,000 for the first one, $23,000 for the second one. Sanctioned again, you know, Scott McKay, the lawyer in the other half of the thing, brought up a vexatious litigant statute, had me declared vexatious a third time, you know, ended up getting $26,000 from the trial court, even though in that case I was represented, and by its terms it doesn't apply to. And then on an appeal, he filed another vexatious litigant statute. Mm. So I've been declared vexatious four times, five times by the state bar and the state courts under a statute that should be interpreted as allowing me to be declared vexatious once. So the fact I was, you know, sanctioned multiple times, $23,000 the first time, and then Mr. McKay had me sanctioned essentially $22,000 at the state court, though I was represented. Then he asked for another vexatious litigant motion in the appeal, and then he was awarded almost $70,000 for prevailing in the appeal. So this isn't a case of my being vexatious. It's really a case of, and first of all, the first time I was declared vexatious, it was by the 730 evaluator who jumped into the family law court, a non-party, by its face, Fozzie versus whatever, Fozzie versus Peterson, you know, a non-party cannot be the recipient of a judgment in their favor. He was a non-party, and Judge Mahoney let him come in. He let him come in, one, when I was this, he was just, there was a changing of the guard. Judge Mahoney was just newly appointed. Perhaps he didn't know, but what had happened was the prior judge in this first vexatious litigant hearing had issued a party scheduling to an ongoing contempt case. So there was an ongoing contempt case. And what happened was that Judge Sullivan was switched out and Judge Mahoney was newly appointed. He didn't know, apparently, that Judge Sullivan had given priority of scheduling to the contempt case. I pled the Fifth Amendment. I had a court-appointed an attorney representing me in the contempt case that my wife brought against me. And so, you know, I didn't go to the first contempt hearing because it was an ongoing criminal case. You know, I pled the Fifth, and my attorney didn't show up. He didn't show up for the two first contempt hearings. So there was a violation of my Fifth Amendment rights. And then the attorney who jumped in, my ex-wife's attorney, Judge Mahoney came into court, and you know, the lawyer, Maria Schopp, and the lawyer who was representing the 730 evaluator who brought the first vexatious litigant, didn't tell the newly appointed Judge Mahoney, one, that there was a schedule of priority given to the contempt case, that I had pled the Fifth Amendment, and that my attorney, Peter First, was unavailable for 6 weeks. So that hearing was held. I didn't even know about it. I didn't know my attorney didn't show up. And Judge Mahoney, 2 weeks after that, set up a hearing and conducted the first vexatious litigant statute, litigant ruling, and ruled against me. So I guess what I'm saying is I've been declared vexatious four times, twice, you know, by Judge Mahoney, based on the same facts, the same parties, in violation of res judicata, collateral estoppel, and also essentially by the fraud of Maria Schopp, the family law attorney opposing counsel, and David Byrne, the attorney for the 730 evaluator. So essentially, I have four vexatious litigant statutes against me, you know, which happened during an ongoing contempt case without my being allowed to object, in violation of my Fifth Amendment right to silence, which I've pled. And these attorneys, Maria Schopp and Mark Byrne, never informed the newly appointed Judge Mahoney that the priority of scheduling was that the contempt case would go first. So in other words, in terms of the vexatious litigant statute, I don't believe there's absolutely any evidence that I'm vexatious. What there's evidence is that the unscrupulous lawyers and have used the vexatious litigant statute to deny access and to deny any kind of hearing. What troubles me about the state bar decision is that they knew and they saw the order where Judge Mahoney, on the afternoon of the hearing, signed this termination order. And the state bar has insisted that there was a hearing on that. Well, there's never been a hearing on the termination of my parental rights. It's never happened. What they have said in their opinion is that, oh, res judicata. Well, you know, there's got to be a hearing. There's got to be some evidentiary. So that I was collaterally estopped, but there's never been a determination on the merits. There's never been a hearing on that. And when I brought that up, Prosecutor Darling referenced the appeal I had taken of my trial by declaration in 2008. He cited that as the basis for collateral estoppel. He claimed that the issue raised in the 2008 appeal, collaterally stopped me from raising the termination of my parental rights. Well, That appeal was never, that appeal involves something that involved my challenge to the trial by declaration, which occurred in 2008. It didn't correspond to the 2010 termination order, which occurred 2 years later. So the state bar just assumed, despite evidence to the contrary, that that issue had been resolved. It had never been resolved. Same thing with some of the other issues, one of which is in the property dispute, I was evicted from my home. I was criminally charged with trespassing on my own property, and I was these charges were made by the court-appointed lawyer in the property dispute. The problem was that that in the property dispute, you know, there was no determination that the court-appointed attorney or court-appointed receiver was a licensed attorney with, you know, authority to practice law. He went into court, argued. He went into court and asked for eviction proceedings. He went into court and asked for an eviction notice. He went into court, asked for the sale of my property. You know, under the state bar, you know, only licensed members of the bar can practice law. He admitted himself he wasn't an attorney, but he said that he was authorized, you know, to practice law, you know, not by any statute or not by any exception to the State Bar Act, but because he was representing his own interest. At the State Bar, I showed case after case where the only person allowed to practice law on behalf of someone else or to go into court is someone who has a financial interest in the outcome of the property. At the hearing, Mr. Singer admitted he had no financial interest in my property, no financial interest in the outcome. He had no, he wasn't an attorney. The things he was doing were, by definition, practicing law, but he said that he was kind of accepted from the prohibition of unlicensed practice of law by non-lawyers, Business and Professional Code 6126, by the fact that he was representing his own interest. Yet the case law, and that's In re Shattuck, 10th Circuit case, and also another case that I cited, that nobody has standing to or legal capacity to file unless they are a member of the bar. His view was that he was representing his own interest. And the case law says the only one with standing is somebody who has a financial interest in the outcome. He admitted he had no financial interest in the outcome of this except to except his representing, you know, acting in a representative capacity as a receiver.
Let me ask you this question, if
sure.
I may. In what venues did you raise this argument that Singer was not eligible to appear in this proceeding?
The first time I raised it, and it's in my, it was in my pleadings before the state court, it was on May 6th, 2014. I filed a pleading, you know, under Business and Professional Code that only licensed attorneys are permitted to practice law. And only people with a financial interest in the outcome have the right to go into court and claim they have an interest, financial interest in the outcome. That gives somebody standing. So on May 6, 2016, I went before Judge Keita Shea in the I had a brain tumor removed on October 4th, and I'm maybe not as coherent as I should be. Anyways, on May 6, 2014, I went before Superior Court Judge Ronald Keita Shea with pleadings saying that Mr. Singer, non-lawyer, was practicing law without a license. I presented the pleadings to Judge Keita Shea, who's head of the eviction proceedings at the Superior Court in San Francisco. He took one look at them. He goes, "This is untimely." And he literally threw the documents down.
So this was in 2016 that you...
This was in 2014.
And when did Singer testify? When did Singer appear? And what year was that?
He appeared pretty much from the beginning, 2012 to 2015. He also appeared and testified that he had the right to practice law. He was coached by State Bar prosecutor Duncan Carling that he had the right to practice law, that sure, he was going into court, sure, he was doing all the things the lawyer did, sure, but he was exempted, or their argument was that he wasn't practicing law because he was representing his own interest. And, you know, under Burbach versus, Burbach versus
I know that case. You cited it in your pleadings.
I have. Okay. Thank you for indulging me. In that case, you know, the state Supreme Court says that the only judicial exemption to practicing law without a license is, allowed by the legislature. And the legislature has provided two exceptions, limited exceptions. You know, so there's never been a judicial exception for non-lawyer receivers. So in Birkbauer, he also said that doesn't mean that that everybody has the right to represent themselves. So I think what Mr. Singer was doing and what the little subtlety he was trying to exploit was that he was saying, you know, he wasn't licensed to practice, he wasn't an attorney, but he was going into court as a receiver, acting in a representative capacity, and representing the estate, but he wasn't practicing law because he was acting in his own interest. But the case law says the only one who can bring an action, you know, under their own name and on their own behalf is an actual party to the litigation. Mr. Singer wasn't a party to the litigation. You know, he wasn't a licensed attorney. And he wants to say that there's some implicit exception that he has the right to represent his own interest. Well, he does if he's if he has some financial stake in the outcome. There was no financial outcome that he had. He had no financial interest. So under the leading authorities in that case, in Ray Shattuck, I think I've quoted, and also the Central District, you know, saying that, you know, a non-lawyer receiver or anybody else without a financial interest has no right to, you know, to bring a claim or to practice law without a license. So under the prevailing law is that if a non-lawyer acts on behalf of someone else, all their decisions are void as a matter of law, jurisdiction, fundamental jurisdiction. They have no right to represent anyone else, much the same way if some, you know, lawyer tried to represent, or a non-lawyer tried to represent a criminal defendant, it would be dismissed because they have no right to represent that. So, you know, that was, you know, what the state bar kind of skirted over that issue and never really addressed that. So I'm rambling a little bit, so if you want to ask me some questions.
Let me observe at this point, Mr. Cunningham, that nearly everything you've said is familiar to me because you stated it in your filings. But I understand the points that you're making. But I did want to ask you on the due process prong of the reciprocal discipline test. Right. It asks whether you were denied due process, notice, opportunity to be heard in the course of the state bar proceedings. And
right.
I'm wondering if you can articulate in sort of due process language whether there's any due process aspect to this. I am inferring from what you're saying and your arguments that essentially you're saying that the evidence was really not sufficient to subject you to the discipline that was imposed because the evidence was all based on determinations that for one reason or another were invalid, void, or the underlying procedures deprived you of certain process. But what I'm really interested in exploring here is whether the actual state bar court proceedings themselves denied you due process.
I understand. And besides the evidentiary matters I brought up, implicit, perhaps it wasn't clear, is that this is kind of a due process violation stacked on a due process violation stacked on a due process violation. I mean, this is something kind of unbelievable.
Well, first, if I might,
yeah,
I understand your discussions about how you were treated in the state trial court, in the superior court, in the district court, in terms of the vexatious litigant issue. And that was the basis for the state bar bringing charges against you, and they relied on the state court proceedings as evidence, as substantial evidence to justify the discipline that they imposed. But I'm asking you a more discreet question, and that is whether the actual state bar court proceedings themselves deprived you of notice. Did you have notice of all the proceedings? Were you allowed to be heard and present evidence in the state bar court proceedings themselves, itself? So that I can, and so our court can evaluate whether the state bar court proceedings themselves afforded you due process, aside from all the other questions about the process you were afforded in the state court and the district court. Do you understand my question?
I do understand your question. I think maybe we're talking about the same thing, or we're talking about one the heads, tails, and we're talking about the same thing, but just coming at it a different way. In the state bar opinion itself, state bar judge Dunn said, there is no basis to allow Mr. Cunningham to challenge any of these rulings because these state bar rulings, these facially void orders, these orders, custody hearing, unlawful practice of law, these issues were never decided. So my defense in the state bar was that I cannot defend myself if I'm denied the right to collaterally attack these issues. I cannot, essentially be told that I cannot defend myself by challenging orders that never even occurred. I cannot challenge, rulings that were never made. My daughter was summarily, deprived of her right to have a father. And when I went to challenge that at the state court, I was denied under the vexatious litigant statute. When I went to challenge the validity of those orders, which is what the state bar bases it on, that all, and in fact, they said all of my efforts to challenge the validity of that order were, for purposes of the state bar, frivolous. At the hearing, or in his opinion, state bar judge Dunn said, there's no reason, we see no reason to allow Mr. Cunningham to collaterally attack these orders. He relied on nothing other than the characterization that the issues had been decided. I brought up, and it's attached here in my 50-page thing, a state Supreme Court order saying that, state Supreme Court opinion saying that one has the right to collaterally attack, orders that have never been finally determined, ultimately determined, and same parties. So the issue of
What cases are those?
Which ones?
The one you just said about the collateral attack, was that something that was that you cited in a particular brief that you can refer me to?
Yeah, that's in my that's in these documents here. If you look in the table of authorities, it's.
Is that something you raised in your petition for review at the state Supreme Court?
Yeah, it is. And the state.
And where is it there? And where did you raise that?
Okay, it's. Lucida, as I recall, is the name of the case.
Lucida,
let's see. In re Lucida, maybe.
Thank you.
Be seated. Be seated at the table of the party.
Okay. Lucido versus Superior Court, 16 and 31. That's 51 Cal 4335. So turning to page 16.
I'm sorry. It's here. I just did not familiar with it.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take a look at that. I don't mean to take up your time with more. I just wanted to be able to follow that thread.
Right, I understand. I wish I were clearer and a little more coherent. But on top of the brain surgery, I started chemo this week. And
so
I hate to put your patience in.
I hate to put you through a difficult time.
The difficulty has been not seeing my daughter for 10 years and then being told I'm vexatious. Being evicted from your own house and then criminally tried for 2 years until the DA dismisses when I demand a jury trial. And then the loss of my house being sold for $400 less than fair market value, and then the court-appointed receiver and the other parties who sued me divvying up almost $1 million of equity that I had my property. You know, it's beyond belief in my...
I understand that. So is there anything that you want to add today? Because what you've basically been saying are matters that are set out clearly in your filings. So I understand the thrust of your argument. All of the arguments that you've been talking about today are familiar to me from your written submissions. Right. You articulate those issues clearly. I'm wondering, you know, it's one of those things where I remember an old judge of our court maybe 40 years ago at oral argument saying he would talk to counsel at the beginning of oral argument and say, "Well, counsel, I want to, before you begin oral argument, I want you to know that if you said anything in the briefs, you don't need to say them again, because we read the briefs. If there's anything you came here to say that's not in the briefs, we don't want to hear about it because it should have been in the briefs and we're not going to hear about it for the first time at oral argument." And having said that, counsel, do you want to say anything? I'm not saying that to you. But I do want to assure you that I have received your written submissions, and that I really don't need you to reiterate what you've already said. But I
understand, and I can't probably, you know, I spent about 15 years working in a legal publishing company, so my skills, I've always recognized, are written. I have time to just go over and go over and whatever. I've never had the skills or the temperament to be a litigator. So I cannot probably express my legal views and, you know, factual basis for those any better than I did in my pleadings. But I would want to just come back briefly and touch on the matter of that you brought up about what is it about the state bar opinion that denies me due process. And if you were to read that opinion, you know, Judge Dunn pretty much says, we're not going to allow you to collaterally attack any of these rulings because, you know, there's a factual basis for them, or there was a final determination on the merits. There has been no final determination on the merits. That's false. That's completely made up. That's fabricated. You know, never has been on those issues, namely the termination of my daughter. That's never happened. Yet the state bar, in its opinion, presumes there must have been some final determination in the state bar. There hasn't been. Same thing with the vexatious.
If you don't mind me,
sure.
Before we go on a while, are you saying that because that kind of an order remains subject to revision over time, so it's never final in the sense that a judgment is sometimes final? And so when you say it wasn't final, is that what you mean? That, well, by the nature of the animal, it never can be a final judgment?
Well, no. And you're right about that. That's a subtle point, and I appreciate the fact that you see that. I'm saying it's not final for two reasons. One, there was never a decision. They never even acknowledged the opinion. They didn't even include that as a document. And in their hearing, they pretty much covered up the fact that on February 26, 2010, Maria Schopp, opposing counsel in the family law case, and the attorney and Judge Mahoney just signed off on this.
Well, wait a minute. You said there was never a decision, but wasn't the decision that you're attacking the one that terminated your rights, or
right? No, and this is where it's subtle. There was I tried to attack it, was denied permission under the vexatious litigant statute. What happened was, you know, 6 weeks later, the family law judge issued his final decision. So he incorporated that February 26, 2010 hearing into his final decision. But it was not a matter brought up at the hearing on February 26. It was not before me. I wasn't even aware that that would be an issue. And one issue, Maria Schopp went in there and she signed my name on this order. And this order said, oh yes, Mr. Cunningham agrees to terminate his parental rights. Of course, I would have never agreed to terminate my parental rights. And Judge Mahoney signed it. So
hold on a second. I want to stick to this question I had.
Right.
I think your point was that there never was a decision, never was a final decision, but then you just said that there was a decision that incorporated this hearing, so that was a decision.
So, no, it wasn't. The order to show cause that I brought up was to restore my 50-50
right.
Hearing. After that hearing, and unbeknownst to me, Attorney Maria Schopp raised the issue of terminating all my parental rights. That was never litigated at the hearing. It was never presented to me. And Judge Mahoney just signed off on it. He then, you know, not only did he sign an order in which she represented that I had voluntarily submitted to the termination of my orders, he signed off on that 6 weeks later. If you look at the February 26th order, it says, and in her proposed termination order, she says, this takes effect February 26th, not March 30th, whatever. So, you know, the point was that the judge never gave me notice of that, never gave me a chance to argue it, and then suggested that somehow his May 30th decision somehow could be a decision prospectively on a you know, on a matter that was never argued, never presented to me, and never spoken about.
Did you appeal that March 30th decision?
I did, and in my I appealed, not the how do you appeal a facially void order? I appealed.
You file an appeal.
The April 12th, the final decision. I appealed that, and it was denied under the vexatious litigant statute. So I was never given an opportunity to challenge the termination of my parental rights, you know. And what happened was this little, legerdemain, a little, you know, where Judge Mahoney seemed to say that his decision that I didn't know about, that I hadn't heard, that we hadn't argued about, was a decision on the termination of our parental rights. So I've been living with that for 10 years. I haven't seen my daughter in 10 years. Every motion, oh, it was decided. Well, where was it decided? Where was it argued? It was never decided. It was a fraud under Penal Code Section 134 when Ms. Schopp went in and represented that, you know, I had, she submitted this document where I supposedly agreed to the termination of my parental rights without a hearing, without notice, and on matters that were never part of the original order to show cause.
Yeah, okay. We're now going over matter that you've already gone over. I don't want to... let me ask you this question, because any order that, the most favorable order that could emanate from here would be an order allowing you to continue practicing in the Ninth Circuit. From a practical standpoint, would your continued membership in the Ninth Circuit Bar be of value to you?
Well, the only reason, and bear with me, I'm kind of long-winded for various reasons. The only time I've gone, you know, to the Ninth Circuit was to bring a class action on behalf of parents who'd been declared vexatious. So the class action involved parents who were declared vexations and denied access to the
court. I know about that case.
Okay, so that was the only real case I've ever brought in the Ninth Circuit. So, you know, I have really no interest in practicing law between, you know, I think that's, I had to, you know, file and become a member of the Ninth Circuit in order to bring that. And I brought that as the prosecuting, or as the attorney of record, as well as a plaintiff.
Yes.
Right. So, and Judge Kosinski, you know, in an unpublished opinion, upheld the ruling of that there was no constitutional violation because at some point these parents might get their kids back. I'm still baffled by that ruling. Anyways, Kosinski was in an unpublished opinion issued obviously before he was kind of, you know, shoot out by, you know, the allegations from his clerks of misbehavior. You know, he did an published opinion. And so that case is still being decided. And so, you know, I have no interest in reviving that or whatever, but what I do plan on doing in probably the 12 months I have left on the face of this earth is to get some justice from, you know, 10 years of not seeing your kid for, you know, what I just see is, you know, just a miscarriage of justice. I wouldn't even say this is a miscarriage of justice. I'd say this is like, you know, back alley abortions by some judicial hacks. It's just been terrifying. Where in the world do you go where you don't see your kid for 10 years and you're denied all court access to challenge that? It just doesn't happen anywhere. So for me, in terms of, you know, I'm here as much about justice and getting a fair hearing as I'm, you know, which I don't really expect anything. And there's really not much skin in the game or not much to lose, other than, you know, another little, you know, slings and arrows of outrageous judiciating, you know. But one thing I am going to do probably in the next 12 months that I exist and before this stage four tumor reasserts itself is I'm going to file, you know, a 1983 action against, you know, the State Bar of California, where, you know, the State Bar of California in its rulings, you know, here, you know, Chief Justice Kantil Sakayui, I'm butchering that, I don't mean to.
I think you did it pretty well, actually.
Thank you. where she's said there's, you know, under Rule 9, 9-16-4, that the weight of authority, justice, all that, that there's no reason to even review the case. Well, if you look at all the state bar actions, Supreme Court actions, you'll see that the California Supreme Court has made three or four rulings on the on the vexatious litigant statute. One of which is interpreted by the plain language, and it then names the remedies, two remedies. Declare someone vexatious, then get a pre-filing order. So all these rulings don't even add up. You know, I was declared vexatious once, and then again, and then again. So the state Supreme Court doesn't even follow its own rulings. So, you know, she claims to review these, you know, decisions and some summary denial, but all these rulings run counter to what the state bar has ruled. The state bar says, oh, Mr. Cunningham, you know, he's been declared vexatious four times. Well, the Supreme Court itself said that Mr. Cunningham, you know, can be declared vexatious once and then get a pre-filing order. It doesn't say Mr. Cunningham can be declared vexatious once, twice, three, four times, be sanctioned $23,000 in this case, $33,000 in that case, $100,000 in this case. It doesn't say that. Yet the state bar, you know, in order to smear me as some crazed, vexatious litigant, brings that up. Well, all Judge Kantil Sakayui needs to do in reviewing that, if she's doing it honestly, is like, you can't, you know, repeatedly sue someone and repeatedly declare them vexatious under the plain language of the vexatious litigant statute. But she does that. And so if she were honest in saying she reviewed her, you know, her opinion or the summary judgment isn't even consistent with their own rulings. So for me, how do you even address that short of bringing a 1983 action in the district court and kind of calling that? What's happening, I think, is that the state bar, you know, has a case on their hand where, you know, there have been so many outrageous rulings by so many judges. They just want this one to disappear, you know, and in a year I'll be dead, and who will really give a shit, right? Except for me, and maybe a handful of people who care about justice. But Chief Justice Sakiyui didn't make her decision for summary, you know, denial based on, you know, she contradicts every ruling made, which she signed off on in doing that. So it's mind-boggling to me. I think they really want to just throw this case under the bus because, you know, you'd have to essentially admit that, you know, dozens of judges have been allowing a non-lawyer receiver to go in court and practice law and receive literally millions of dollars in fees for practicing law without a license. And so, you know, in the next year I have alive, that's what I hope. I realize there's not a whole bunch at stake in your ruling. I would hope you would, you know, follow the law and follow the precedents and look at the facts and just, you know, scratch your head and say, how does this add up? Why is he being disbarred? Why is this non-lawyer receiver practicing law? Why are the parties that who, you know, sued him, you know, why are they bringing an action in the state bar when he's not even, you know, he has no clients in the state bar? You know, he's, you know, I'm being disciplined, you know, for being an attorney and defending myself. Essentially, there's nothing in the state bar law, in the State Bar Act, that says, yes, an attorney who too vigorously defends himself and who too vigorously tries to get his daughter back is filing frivolous litigation under the State Bar Act, as we define it, even though Birkbauer says only the legislature can define that. And we're going to declare Mr. Cunningham, you know, we're going to discipline him for filing frivolous actions, you know, when he's a defendant. It's just astonishing to me. You know, and maybe it's the tumor, you know, but I've only had the tumor, you know, up until October 3rd when it was removed. You know, this has been going on for 10 years. I haven't seen my daughter in 10 years. I haven't been able for 10 years. I'm not going to see my daughter for 10 years, and I'm going to die without seeing her, and I'm going to be told I'm some crazed, vexatious litigant. It just offends my sense of fair play, justice, and the fact that the people who do have power are not held accountable at all.
Are you going to be able to see your daughter? Is she approaching an age where you would be able to
see
her?
She's turned 18, you know, and...
Can't you see her now if she's willing?
Well, yes. You know, and people ask me that. I go, I know when she was 9 or 10, you know, she probably loved me as much as anything in the world. I know her mother... has gotten 2 restraining orders against me. For what, you might ask? For disturbing her peace of mind by asking her to share custody with her daughter under the liberal San Francisco whatever. That I interrupted the mother's peace of mind by emailing her, never talked to her, never looked at her, never, you know, sent her some emails, say, let's end this crazy, let's end this madness and share custody of my daughter. Her attorney got a restraining order and then got it renewed for interfering with her peace of mind.
Yeah. Well, I will consider all the matters that you stated. You've raised issues, and I promise you I will consider those. My role now is to prepare a report and recommendation about...
I understand. Could I just quickly say one thing? Again, I have mentioned that I'm going to file a 1983 suit, and I would just ask that that be mentioned in your hearing, or that you maybe even forego a formal decision pending the outcome of my 1983 claim, because I'll be able to file, you know, the seven volumes of things that I didn't really have time to get, with all the testimony of various people. I can put that into my 1983 suit. So I guess I would ask that, you know, that you would say, okay, Mr. Cunningham intends to file this 1983 claim. It'll give him a greater opportunity to present evidence. And since there are no clients of his in the Ninth Circuit, because he has no clients, he's got a brain tumor and he's going to die, so there's really not any great risk to his practicing law in the Ninth Circuit because he has no clients there, that the Ninth Circuit just say, you know, we're going to forego this formal decision until there's been a ruling in the district court on his 1983 motion. I don't know if you have that authority to do that. I don't see why you wouldn't. But I certainly would appreciate that. And there's really no skin off your teeth, because, you know, if things go accordingly, I'll be dead in a year anyways.
Well, let me propose this. Because I don't think it's appropriate for me to act on your verbal request as you stated it. I'm also
reluctant.
Well, it's hard for me to justify staying this matter, which is limited to addressing what's occurred already in this state court, pending the initiation of another action that's likely to take months, many, many months, if not years, to be resolved. If you want to defer action in this case, then what I would recommend is that you file a formal motion in this disciplinary action asking to stay proceedings on whatever basis, however you want to articulate the basis. It will come to me. It is likely that what I will do is issue a report and recommendation. In the report and recommendation, I will also address the motion to stay. The report and recommendation will be sent to you. You'll have several weeks in which to read it, and if you so choose, file a response to it, objections or the agreement with it. Then my report and recommendation, plus any submission you have, will be submitted to a 3-judge panel of the court. And then they will decide whether to adopt my recommendation or reject my recommendation or remand it to me for further proceedings. So
I understand, and I appreciate it, and it's procedurally probably the appropriate way to go. But, you know, it kind of brings up the other underlying issue in this is in this disciplinary proceeding, the state bar summarily denies my motion. At least half of the charges the state bar has brought against me are federal opinions and decisions.
Okay, I get you made that argument very clearly about the jurisdiction of the state bar over matters that occurred in federal court. That's one of the issues that I'm going to have to address.
So, you know, it just seems to me, you know, how the state Supreme Court can suggest that it, you know, reviewed, you know, my federal constitutional questions in a summary motion when the state bar had no jurisdiction to do that. I mean, how does the state Supreme Court, you know, how is it presumed to have ruled on a matter the state bar has no jurisdiction to even consider? I mean, it's a paradox. So,
Mr. Cunningham,
I understand. We're
going over ground you've already covered.
I understand.
And I don't...
I understand.
I think that I'm very satisfied that you've made a complete presentation. I think your written presentation is comprehensive. And I appreciate you appearing today. And I do wish you the best of luck dealing with your health issues.
No, I appreciate that.
I want you to know that. And so I think it's time now to conclude the hearing. And I will then spend time studying your submissions carefully, considering what you've said here today as well. And I'll prepare a report and recommendation. If you wish to file any motions after the hearing, I'm happy to take that into consideration as well, as we discussed.
Sure. The only question I'd have is, what is your timeline look like on issuing a order and everything else?
You know, we have so many matters that we're dealing with. It would almost certainly not be done in less than a week and a half from today. I doubt we would be able to get anything out next week. Even the following week may be optimistic, but we will try and do it as quickly as possible.
Well, I'd prefer the slower, the better.
All right.
Just because I'll finish my 1983 motion and submit that as something to be considered. So again, I just feel I'm having spent 15 years working in legal publishing that I'm better at expressing myself through the written word than spoken word. So the longer you can take, the better. It gives me, I could probably kick out a 1983 motion within days if I hadn't had my brain scrambled in the surgery, and I'm not.
Don't worry about it. It'll be a couple of weeks before we get something out.
I appreciate that.
Okay. All right. So this matter is then submitted. And is there anybody that's present with you in the district court there who's a technician?
I just need to
knock. All right.
Knock on the door. And
so if you don't mind, would you convey our appreciation for their assistance in making this video conference possible?
Yes, and I would thank your clerk for arranging this and having the patience to put this all together. I appreciate it.
Okay.
I can't drive, so there's no way I was going to get out to California. So.
Right.
I appreciate it.
All right. Well, good luck to you, and thank you for appearing today.
Thank you.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.